For the new puzzle, tell me when a half is a quarter. I'm looking for two answers that are both physical things, not nothing or the null set. So again, send me two answers where a half is a quarter. When you have an answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
2 divided by 0, 0, 2 divided by 0, 0, 0.
Let's not go home, we'll catch the late train. I've got enough money to pay on the way. When the postman calls, he'll deliver the letter. I've explained everything.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of April 15th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 18th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegedoff and Farah Siddiqui, the producers Annette Newell, and our engineers Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Willamette on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for listening. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Dictatorship and drug trafficking in Latin America. Last week, I reported on the left versus right confrontations between Mexico and Ecuador, reflecting the growing divide in Latin America between left-leaning countries such as Mexico, Brazil, Colombia, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, and right-leaning countries such as Ecuador, Peru, Argentina, and Bolivia. Now add El Salvador to the list of repressive right-wing governments. The administration of Nayib Bukele has become another dictatorship by popular demand, ruthlessly suppressing not just drug traffickers, which has attracted international as well as Salvadoran admiration, but also political opponents, critics, and the judicial system. If you think of Rodrigo Duterte of the Philippines and his war on drugs, you get the idea. Bukele has around 80% popular support, mainly for jailing people involved in the drug trade. Some 70,000 people are in prison, many without due process, a particular instance of the general problem of human rights and constitutional violations for which Bukele offers no apologies. As for Ecuador, it faces an even greater problem than El Salvador with drug trafficking. The country is sometimes characterized as a narco state. Back in December, the Attorney General announced a number of arrests of people in law enforcement who were tied to gangs, saying it's a, quote, a clear X-ray of how drug trafficking has taken over the institutions of the state. That's the point at which the gangs responded with violence against the police and in prisons. One gang invaded a major TV station and held several people hostage. President Daniel Noboa signed a declaration of internal armed conflict, naming 22 gangs as terrorist organizations and asserting that they have about 40,000 men. The dispute with the gangs, he said, is over our way of life. An historic upgrade to U.S.-Japan relations. A summit meeting April 10 and 11 between President Biden and Prime Minister Kishida Fumio has resulted in major changes in U.S.-Japan security relations. These follow on a common evaluation of the threat posed by China, North Korea's increasing missile potential, and Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Prior to the summit, Kishida said, quote, "The current security environment is tough and complex, and we are at a turning point in history. Cooperation between Japan and the United States and like-minded countries is a very important issue," unquote. Among the agreements reached by the two leaders are, first, an improved military common command and control system, co-production of certain missiles for air defense, Japanese participation in U.S. space missions, major new private investments in each other's country, including an investment by Toyota of nearly $8 billion for electric car battery production in Greensboro, North Carolina, which is expected to create 3,000 jobs. U.S. and Japanese corporations will also invest in AI research at both countries' universities, including the University of Washington. New high-level dialogue on ways to meet climate change objectives. U.S. support of Japan's restarting of nuclear reactors, a rather surprising addition given the unpopularity in Japan of nuclear power since the Fukushima tragedy. And finally, but unmentioned, the controversy of Nippon Steel's bid to take over U.S. Steel, which was left unmentioned. The upgrade in U.S.-Japan security relations is not surprising given Japan's changing strategic perspective in the last few years. Its military spending has jumped, its weapons modernization program has advanced, and it has joined with the U.S. in the so-called Quad, the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue that includes India and Australia. Recently announced is a U.S.-Japan-Australia-Philippines joint naval exercise in disputed waters of the South China Sea. The U.S., Japan, and Philippines held a first-ever joint White House Security Conference April 11, with China's, quote, coercive and unlawful, that's Biden's words, actions in the South China Sea, the main topic. And now, as part of the Biden-Kishida summit, Japanese involvement with the AUKUS security group, Australia, United Kingdom, and U.S., will also be under discussion. All these moves have China in mind, further stoking tensions in East Asia. China has always been concerned about Japan again becoming a military power, and now that Japan is a member of the Quad and potentially of AUKUS, Beijing is expressing alarm. Its foreign ministry issued a statement that said, in part, quote, U.S.-Japan relations should not forget other countries, harm their interests, or undermine regional peace and stability. China firmly opposes the Cold War mentality and small group politics. China firmly rejects anything that creates and drives up tensions and may undermine other countries' strategic security interests. Looking at U.S. policy from China's perspective, it has to seem disturbingly inconsistent with Washington's professed intentions. On April 2nd, just prior to the summits with Japan and the Philippines, Biden had a telephone conversation with Xi Jinping that didn't break new ground but did have an overall positive appraisal of the relationship. According to the Chinese readout of the conversation, Xi said relations have stabilized. Let's see whether Xi regards the latest U.S.-Japan-Philippines arrangements as confrontational or stabilizing. Environmental justice, a court ruling, and a banking study. The European Court of Human Rights in France has ruled that Switzerland had violated its citizens' rights by failing to meet climate change standards. The case was brought by a local French mayor and students from Portugal under the European Convention on Human Rights. They were joined by Senior Women for Climate Protection, Swiss women ages 64 and older, who were backed by Greenpeace. The plaintiffs were only awarded their expenses. It is up to the Swiss government to make policy changes to conform with the ruling. The ruling cannot be appealed. To comply with the court's ruling, Switzerland will have to re-examine its investment pattern. According to Reuters, quote, the financial sector, including the central bank, is already under pressure from environmental groups to curb the number of climate-damaging transactions it processes. Data published last month by the Swiss National Bank showed that its investments were linked to 12 million metric tons of carbon emissions in 2023, unquote. Switzerland has major investments in Chevron and ExxonMobil. Those investments link the country's trade and financial sectors, producing challenges to the way Switzerland normally does business. Speaking of the banking industry, a study of how its avowed commitment to fighting climate change has worked out shows that such voluntary acts do not produce results. big banks had signed on to the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero a few years ago, promising to change their lending practices to support the effort to rein in climate change. But the study by the European Central Bank and various economists, quote, cast doubt on the efficacy of voluntary climate commitments for reducing financed emissions, whether through divestment or engagement, unquote. While banks had reduced lending to the oil and gas industries, the reduction was nowhere near what is necessary to make a dent in climate change, the study found. In other news, is there a new NATO mission forthcoming in the Ukraine war? With uncertainty rising over U.S. reliability in assisting Ukraine's defense, NATO's leadership is seeking to have the organization take over as the principal outlet for military aid to Ukraine. The so-called Ukraine Defense Contact Group, based in Germany, which coordinates aid provided by NATO's 32 members, plus about 18 other countries. The leadership is proposing to raise $100 billion in 5 years. This potential change, and it is only that since Hungary is likely to object and the U.S. itself is not yet on board, comes as President Zelensky takes the politically risky step of changing the draft law. The new law will lower the draft age from 27 to 25 and end various exemptions. Ukraine has suffered huge casualties, especially of late due to the Russian offensive and lack of sufficient weapons. But Ukraine has to be buoyed by renewed talk of NATO membership, with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken saying membership is on the horizon. Ukraine membership will be taken up at the next NATO summit in July. A few notes from the Israel-Hamas war. While Iran's attack on Israel and Israel's response have dominated the headlines, the war inside Israel goes on without relief. First, following on warnings from Biden, aid shipments into Gaza have improved significantly, according to Israel, reaching over 400 trucks a day at times. But Biden said there is still room for improvement, and the UN aid agency says the actual figure is about half of what Israel is reporting. Next, the newspaper Haaretz reports that barely 3 months into the year, 2024 has already seen a record amount of West Bank land declared as state-owned property by Israel. The civil administration in Israel in recent years has been steadily eating into West Bank land, and it is safe to assume the goal is to expand Israeli settlements there. And finally, in the ongoing negotiations in Cairo, though a six-week ceasefire seems to be acceptable to all sides, the number of Hamas prisoners who might be released in exchange for 40 Israeli hostages is being further complicated by a Hamas statement that it does not hold 40 hostages who fit the proposed criteria, which include most everyone except young men and male soldiers. Is Iran moving closer toward acquiring a nuclear weapon? The Trump administration's decision to withdraw from the nuclear agreement with Iran may finally get its just reward, an Iranian nuclear bomb. International inspectors of Iran's nuclear facilities have reportedly found alarming evidence of highly enriched uranium being produced at Iran's most important and most secret nuclear fuel production site, known as Fordow. The Washington Post reports that Iran is now, quote, closer to nuclear weapons capability than at any time in the country's history, according to confidential inspection reports and interviews with officials and experts who closely monitor Iran's progress, unquote. Estimates are that Iran could have a deliverable weapon in 2 years. It is not hard to imagine that all this is old news to Israel's intelligence community. With tensions with Iran very high again, an Israeli strike on Fordow becomes quite conceivable and quite alarming. But Israel has only itself to thank for Iran's quest for a nuclear weapon. The war with Hamas has pushed leaders in Tehran not only to support those opposed to Israel, but also to see a nuclear bomb as their best option for deterring a U.S. or Israeli attack on Iran. Finally, South Korea's legislative election is a blow to its president. South Koreans went to the polls April 10 to elect 300 National Assembly members. The results were a devastating defeat for the party of President Yoon Suk-yeol, who still has 3 years left to serve on his 5-year term and now becomes a lame duck. The main opposition party of Lee Jae-myung, who challenged Yoon for the presidency 2 years ago, won 190 seats to Yoon's party's 108 seats. The result does not quite give Lee's party a supermajority, but it does give it, and him, an opportunity to block anything Yoon proposes or force Yoon to negotiate. Lee Jae-myung will no doubt run again for president, assuming he doesn't get caught up in some scandal. His foreign policy views differ substantially from Yoon's: closer ties to China, engagement with North Korea, distancing from Japan. However, 3 years is a long way off, and in Korean politics, a lifetime. Many domestic issues, starting with the economy and housing prices, dominate the political agenda, more so than international issues, and there is no telling what the domestic scene might look like in a few years. Of course, a crisis with North Korea is always possible, and perhaps soon, as the North increases its missile testing. Being a lame duck president at such a time could shape President Yoon's response. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Bertie. Recently, I interviewed Tony Fujiwara, the youth coordinator for Rose City Self-Defense. The program offers empowerment-based self-defense and personal safety workshops to people in the Portland area. City officials threatened to cut the budget for the program. I spoke with Tony to learn more about the program, its history, and the important role it plays in the community. So first off, I do want to thank you for not only being here today, but also for helping our community members feel safer.
I love what we do.
Great. Tell us about the Rose City Self-Defense Program.
So Rose City Self-Defense was started in 1979, and it was known as the Strengths Program. So a lot of folks are familiar with Women's Strength and the Girls' Strength and Boys' Strength. We were under the Portland Police Bureau up until 2022, in which our volunteers kind of made a decision that the population that we are trying to serve best, which are queer folks, women, Black and brown people, weren't feeling necessarily safe attending self-defense courses at a police station. And so they advocated and met with city council to have the program moved under the Community Safety Division. And with that, we decided that the naming was becoming gender exclusive. So we renamed ourselves Rose City Self-Defense, but it's the same programming that has been with the city of Portland since 1979. We listened to a lot of the feedback, and that was pretty much across the board the common.
That's awesome. I'm glad that you guys are aware of the people that you serve. So Tony, what brought you to this type of public service work? Did you already have prior experience with teaching or learning self-defense?
I'm a former teacher, but zero experience in self-defense. As a high school public school teacher for 18 years, but I was also a girls rugby coach and boys rugby, focusing primarily on high school age. So I was teaching a lot of girl-identifying folks how to connect with their body for the first time. Some of them, most of them, had never played a sport before. So what I'm teaching them is body positivity and really seeing this development of believing in themselves through this really inclusive sport. And I thought, how do I teach folks the same lessons of all the beautiful things about your body and apply it to the whole group? And lo and behold, this position opened up last April, and that's how I ended up as an empowerment-based trauma-informed self-defense instructor.
That is incredible. I am so glad that you made it to where you are today. We definitely need more active do-gooders in the world. You know, as you mentioned, Portland's community members are so diverse, and we all have our different stories and experiences. What kind of people does the Rose City Self-Defense Program aim to serve?
So primarily, originally, we were created to help serve cis and trans women and non-binary folks who are comfortable in women-centered spaces. And then as the program grew, our target audience grew as well. And we really are specifically trying to hit those with disabilities, sex workers, the LGBTQI2S community, and those, all of those who feel sort of underrepresented and underserved with the resources that have traditionally been accessible. And so recently, even, we have expanded a little bit more and included all genders in our personal safety and self-defense workshops.
Awesome. And I feel like it makes so much sense, because the people that you mentioned, those groups, are the people that need to be able to defend themselves more than, you know, cisgendered people or able-bodied people in general, I could say.
Yeah.
So as you mentioned earlier, Rose City Self-Defense did experience a change in management from Portland Police Bureau to the new Community Safety Division back in July of 2022. And so I was wondering, how did this affect the self-defense program?
So luckily, the program itself didn't change much. We still offer this empowerment-based trauma-informed self-defense, but now we operate under the Safe Blocks program under the Office of Violence Prevention, which means we're really trying to focus a lot of our services to those areas in the city that have traditionally been underserved. So think about Outer East Portland, Coley neighborhood, North Portland. And so we provide these services for free all over, but we're going to make sure those areas have the first dibs at it before we start hitting less impacted areas. So we kind of look at socioeconomics, we look at social vulnerability, and then we also look at where is the violence happening the most. And that's where we're going to try to concentrate our services.
So Rose City Self-Defense emphasizes the idea of empowerment-based self-defense. So how might that play a role in the student's personal life experience?
So with empowerment-based self-defense, what we're doing is we're not just teaching the physical skills. We're going to teach all those tools that are innate with us, that we have within us, that can help keep us safe before we have to use those skills. So think about reconnecting with your intuition, but then we're also going to unpack how bias can affect that intuition, and so that we can start to learn to really start to trust our intuition and do the work to know that it's not bias that's causing our alarms to go off. Then we're going to teach folks how to be assertive and how to set boundaries using a really handy model. We're going to teach them how to de-escalate situations. We're going to give them escape options so that ultimately self-defense skills are going to be our last resort.
I think it makes complete sense to view self-defense as empowering. And I think it's important to remember that having the ability to react in those stressful fight or flight kind of situations requires a lot of confidence in yourself. And as you said, not just in terms of physical skill, but mental skill as well. And I think that de-escalation and making sure that you don't have to have the physical interaction go on is it's really smart.
No, and the thing too, what I really appreciate about these classes is we really draw on our students' experiences and try to tailor it to them too. So we're not here to give a silver bullet answer. We can't solve the problem of predators preying on folks, and you know that's always going to be a problem until we address the root causes there. But we can do is give you options and tools, bring them to the surface, give you a space to practice it so that they're at the forefront of your brain. And you know, for us, we're not asking people to be paranoid, we're asking people to be prepared. And that is really how we can give you the best feelings of safety, is that preparedness and those opportunities to practice.
So Rose City Self-Defense is just one of those programs that are supported by the Office of Violence Prevention. Can you tell us about some of the other programs they support, like Safe Blocks or Youth Against Violence?
Yeah. So the Office of Violence Prevention is pretty special. It was created many, many years ago, but it was really starting to see more focus on it as of recently when the city of Portland had their gun violence declaration. And so with that, we've been really focusing for the Office of Violence Prevention on gun violence within gangs. And we're seeing, with a collaborative effort, we are seeing some change in that. So with that, they have Youth Against Violence, which is originally known as Boy Strength under the Strengths Program. And that targets youth in communities that have high violence. And these programs are meant to be pro-social, so they teach youth at a young age how to believe in themselves, how to interrupt violence when they see it, how to be allies, and really gives them explicit tools to stop the cycle of violence. So that's the Youth Against Violence program. It's kind of a brother program to the Rose City Self-Defense Youth Programming. And then the Safe Blocks program, they're out there doing crime prevention through environmental design. What they can go is assess properties and give you help on, hey, these bushes need trim, this lighting here, entryways, how to make sure that you can kind of design a space to be safer. They also do placemaking work where they're out in engaging communities, activating spaces in communities to help the community solve the problems together. And those all kind of form those pro-social, empowering people to take back their own safety, right? And not rely on other people to make them feel safe, but know that they have the potential and ability to create it if they just come together. And I think all of those programs work together to take the pressure off of traditional responses, so we're not relying on police or whatnot to fix the problems, but we as a community can come together and do that.
I love that. That is really incredible. And Portland as a community has dealt with a lot in terms of the Portland Police Bureau. And so I think that taking all of these issues that involve trauma and involve mental health skills
viewing them in a more trauma-informed way mm-hmm. is so helpful. And I think that's really going to help Portland, you know, progress as a city.
Absolutely. You know, trying to address the root causes to these problems instead of just putting Band-Aids on the end results.
Right, definitely. Sometimes you need surgery. Mm-hmm. So how can those other programs benefit Portland's community members in the long run?
Well, these are some of those value-added services, meaning these are provided for free. Your tax dollars have already paid for this. So community members can request personal safety workshops, de-escalation training, youth workshops that are all centered around safety and self-defense and empowerment and leading with empathy, teaching people to give that empathy first before we start to go into different strategies so that we can see it before it happens. Maybe we can interrupt it and potentially divert our traditional responses and start to kind of see that there are other ways that we can start to attack these problems, and that if we can build confidence in youth so that they're not attracted to the violence because they have their value, they know their self-worth, they love themselves, then maybe we can start to interrupt those long-term effects.
Definitely. You know, you only know what you've been taught, right? So that being said, I hear the city of Portland wants to cut the budget for the Rose City Self-Defense Program and Youth Against Violence Program next year. So how would that impact the programs and the youth in our community?
So, yeah, because we fall under the Community Safety Division, which is the public safety service area, we are in the same budget pool as Portland Fire, Portland Police, and numerous other emergency response sort of traditional organizations. A lot of those budgets are what we would consider untouchable. So when looking for where they could make cuts, it was decided that Rose City Self-Defense and Youth Against Violence would be the cuts. And so the way that would impact it is those programs would ultimately disappear. It's not the jobs of the folks who run those, it's the actual programs themselves. Rose City Self-Defense provides services for domestic violence, and that's the only provider in the city of Portland. There's nobody else that the city of Portland has. You know, we're specifically supporting women, queer communities, and it feels very counterproductive to the end mission of the city, which is to create a safe city and to have folks feel safe in their city. And so we are here on the ground providing these trainings that people walk away from. We have surveys and results and the data that show that we have an increased feelings of safety up to 70 to 80% increase from the time they walked into our class to the time they left. Another thing folks are recognizing is because we teach about healthy relationships and what intimate partner violence could look like, is folks are walking in not realizing that they have been victims of domestic violence and intimate partner violence, and they are leaving with this realization that they have been and that perhaps it's time to get out of it. And so that kind of training, you don't get that anywhere else, let alone for free. And the city of Portland has been one of the few cities in the nation to provide these services for no cost to all the participants.
Yeah, that's incredibly heartbreaking to know that all of these people who really need help are not going to be able to receive it. And as you said, yes, I totally agree that it is counterproductive to cut these programs because these programs are prevention, right, for all of these issues that, you know, Portland Police Bureau or, you know, even the ambulance might serve
through our volunteer program. So there's only two paid employees through Rose City Self-Defense.
Oh, wow.
But it's nearly all volunteer driven. So we have about 40 volunteers who end up running most of the classes. And so again, for just two full-time employees, you're getting thousands of hours of trainings provided to thousands of people within the city of Portland.
What kind of support do Rose City Self-Defense and the Youth Against Violence Program need from the community?
So if folks have an opinion and feel strongly that these programs, in either way, should exist or not, we ask that you go to your commissioners directly and let them know how you feel. Let them know the value of these programs and taking away programs that support Black and Brown communities, women of color, disabled folks, the LGBTQ community. There's very few services for them as is, let alone free, where people walk away with real tangible skills to help interrupt the cycle of violence and empower themselves to feel safe in the space that they take up. And so if that is something that you feel strongly about, and either way, voice that opinion to your commissioners, because they are the ones who ultimately will be making the vote. So that's Commissioner Gonzalez, Commissioner Rubio, Commissioner Ryan, Commissioner Mapps, or Mayor Wheeler.
Okay, so if our listeners are, you know, interested in finding out more information about these programs and maybe even signing up for them before they get cut, what's the best way for them to do that?
So the easiest way is to just search Rose City Self-Defense. We are the first website that will come up. We're under the City of Portland. It would be something like www.portland.gov/CSD/Rose City Self-Defense. So just search Rose City Self-Defense. You'll see it pop up. And in there, it's going to give you a calendar of all the classes we have offered. Our April ones are halfway through right now, so we won't be accepting that. But we have two community classes in May. We have two community classes in June. We have a youth class in June. We also are going to be doing some summer programming if we're able to continue beyond July 1st, some summer camps for the youth. Any of those can be accessed. We have a registration that opens up 1 month before. If you are interested in taking a class, make sure you mark that date on your calendar, because these classes do fill up within about 48 hours. That speaks volumes about the demands. People are waiting, and then we're hitting a wait list. And that wait list, within about 72 hours, our classes are full and we're no longer accepting registrations. So if you do find a class that you want to take, make note of that registration opening and try to get on that quickly.
Okay, great. I love that. People are really accessing these programs too, as you mentioned. That's really awesome. Any final thoughts?
Well, I just to wrap up, Rose City Self-Defense is the only service that provides free empowerment-based trauma-informed self-defense for the city of Portland. And in order to take back the city and feel like we have a right to the space and know that we are worth defending, these programs need to stick around.
Thank you so much for being with us, Tony.
I appreciate you so much. Thank you.
That was Tony Fujiwara, the youth coordinator for Rose City Self-Defense. We talked about the resources the program has to offer to Portland's most vulnerable and historically underserved community members. Portland City government has plans to stop funding the program due to